Let's jump right into it, Mark. I'm Matt Rienzo here with Mark Weller. Welcome and thanks for joining us. Mark, we have an epic show today, don't we?
Yeah, no doubt. Very, very exciting.
We're very thrilled to welcome Tim Lywicki and Francesca Bodie of the Oakview Group to the show. Tim is the chairman and CEO, and Francesca is the president of business development. And together with their team, they're one of the leading arena developers in the world. But they're much more than that. They operate where sports, music, culture, and entertainment all intersect, which we're going to hear about just in a second, Mark. So let's invite them on.
Tim, Francesca, welcome. How are you?
I thought this was Travis's. This is yours? I thought I was supposed to be doing the one with Taylor Swift's boyfriend.
No.
That's next. They're coming on in the next. Who told them?
Okay. I'm confused.
For a show like yours, that would be an appropriate introduction.
It would be appropriate, but it's annoying at this point. Nobody wants to hear about it anymore, quite frankly. My kids turn it off now when it comes on TV. We watch football all weekend. So I think it's overplayed. But yeah, that's a different story.
But that's right where you all live. I mean, it's in the intersection of sports and music and culture and everything. So we definitely want to talk a bit about that. And I know we first met you when you were looking at doing an arena in Baltimore. And I'll let Mark intro that topic.
Well, it was an exciting time. And we were looking to add to that massive project we built in Baltimore, the Port Covington project. And we were really serious about an arena. And we found the perfect partner, I felt like, which was Tim and Francesca and Oakview. And I think the issue became it was build a new one or renovate. And Tim and his team and all their wisdom figured out that they could, in fact, redo the Baltimore Arena into what it is now, which is really an amazing story. And a lot of people doubted that could ever happen and become a functional arena. I never questioned it for a second because of what I knew about them and what I knew about Tim and his track record and Francesca and her attitude towards this and how they were approaching this. But it was a heavy lift and they pulled it off, and it's really successful and it's a great thing for the city.
Yeah. So we had planned to talk about that a little later in the show, but since we're on it, Tim, tell us about that project and tell us about, you know, how that unfolded, and just give us a little flavor for what's there in Baltimore now and the impact that it's having.
So actually, Mark is being very nice. He eliminated one of the steps that we ultimately had to go through when we finally got to the realization that the only political way to get a deal done in Baltimore was the renovation. And that was, we went way down the road on Port Covington, and it was actually a brilliant concept, because what it was a point of destination that would have been another moment of redefining Baltimore and creating some usages with people like the NBA and people like the music community, including our current partner, Pharrell, and doing things there that would have transformed the economy and the people that ultimately would have come to visit Baltimore. So what happened is, like happens, you get swallowed up in politics. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody has a project. Everybody's directing you on, no, we want this, we want that, we want here, we want there. So where we ultimately got to from this brand new point of destination, multi-billion dollar project with some of the biggest companies in the world. Then the next step was we were being directed to go look at the recycling plant that was the incinerator, and they were saying, we want you to build there. And I'm like, are you serious? Do you understand what's underneath that soil? And do you understand the cleanup that it would take to build it there? And that's where we got stuck. And we were stuck there for about 6 months until the children's book. What do you call that period of time?
The children's book debacle.
Yeah, I have kids. I was thinking about the children's book. Yes, the scandal with the children's book with the man. Scandal.
It gets even worse. Is my daughter's name is Holly, and so we call her Happy Holly, and that was, I think, the name of the book.
Yeah, it was Holly something. Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, you're bringing up some crazy stuff. Yes, this is all true.
Look, I couldn't make this up if I tried, and so. Nope. We got caught up in the, and again, I know this, you're not going to hear this very often, but the children's book scandal, and then that kind of disappeared. And to the credit of the current mayor, he came in, and ultimately he was really focused on saying, I don't want to build a new arena on the water in the port. I don't want to build a new arena at the incinerator plant. I want you to go figure out, can you bid on taking the current arena and renovating it? That's what we did, and that's what worked out. And quite frankly, Mark, as you know, the demand, the people and the artists that want to come to be a part of Baltimore, the ability to begin to have a renaissance and a rejuvenation of the urban core in Baltimore, we're seeing the very beginning of that, and I am very optimistic about where Baltimore is going. And by the way, I think for Francesca and myself and our team at Oakview Group, we could go build new arenas in Austin. That's easy. It doesn't take you long to figure out, hey, Austin, Texas is kind of a happening, quirky little town. Let's go build a new arena there because they don't have one. Same in Seattle.
And you also, though, in fairness, you ran the Baltimore Blast, correct? Was it your first job? You were the youngest GM. There's something pretty awesome there. You were in Baltimore for a while, so you knew the city. You knew a little bit about it.
His office was still in the building before we renovated
it. I
didn't turn it into a museum.
I have been mugged on my walk home many a night, but that's why I look at Baltimore today and go, no. It's a lot better than it used to be. And in fact, we developed a great relationship with Mayor Schaefer, and I saw the rejuvenation of Baltimore during that period of time with the Inner Harbor and the Rouse Company investment and the aquarium and the World Center that was built there. And so, look, I've seen the good. I've seen the bad. I've seen people kind of poop all over Baltimore, and I've seen Baltimore stand up, shake it off, reinvent itself. And there's a reason they call it Charm City.
That's right. You know, but I want to personally thank you. I've spent 10 or 13 years of my life working really hard to help improve that city. And I think I did my small part, but your part was huge. And I want to thank you and your team for that. And there's so many people that feel the same way as me too. So,
yeah, no doubt. And it's interesting when we first met, 6 years ago or however long ago that was, we were kindred spirits in that we were totally bullish on Baltimore. And the way you're talking about it is the same way we talk about it. And it's great to see it come to fruition in the form of a new arena that's doing well. So that's awesome. And it's such an integral part of any city being a great place, in my opinion. We'll talk more about
Matt,
that. But
Matt, we're going to talk about it. Let's get to that now, though, while we're at it, though. You all have such a huge part of these various cities you work in when you come in and build an arena, whether you're coming into an existing neighborhood or going into a neighborhood new and kind of helping bring something there or rejuvenate something. Tell us how you view sort of the development of arenas and what it does for the direct community, larger community abroad, the job situation, et cetera, et cetera. Like, tell us your thoughts on that.
Francesca, you want to take it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you said, and we were kindred spirits in this in our early conversations, which is we have to be rooted in the communities that we serve. And so it's very important that not just from a values and a culture perspective, but also from all the way up the food chain, from the type of food you serve to the type of staff and how they greet the people in the building, how we're talking to sponsors, how we integrate corporate partners. It has to be rooted. If we were trying to do this from LA or Denver or wherever, and then trying to bestow that on the cities that we came into, it would not be as successful. So I think one of our recipes for success, if you will, is really taking on the identity of the community. And so I think in this particular case in Baltimore, just to stay in that storyline, we inherited a GM that had been there for 35 years. I mean, Frank Remish, there's nobody in the city. No one.
Frank's a legend. Yeah,
Frank's a legend.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Hey, by the way, I'm convinced that Frank the Tank in the movie came from Frank Remish.
It might have.
Frank is one of the best operators I have ever worked with. And I didn't know him before we started this process. And in fact, it was in some ways an arranged marriage, because it was important for us that the current staff didn't lose their jobs in the transition that the city went through with the RFP. And yet we inherited this incredible knowledge base that was rooted in Baltimore, all about it, understood the city. And that's that recipe, right? Where now we're seeing the success, the momentum in the building. And then now, with Frank's team, they were excited to join our culture, which at OBG has really been driven by entrepreneurial spirit and risk-taking, thinking outside the box, challenging our sports and entertainment building, as it's always been. And now you're seeing the first Latin shows that have ever played Baltimore, and they're selling out. And we're proving that, artists like Mariah Carey are choosing Baltimore over DC. And we never tried to make it an either or. We think it's two different markets, but we're seeing that demand, that vibe that's been created. And it's that balance of rooting in it. So I think it's important.
And what I'd say is, look, you got to find a fine balance in life. We began the company when I was at the ripe old age of 59 after building companies for other people. And part of the vision and part of the desire was, yes, you economically have to make sense out of these things. Because if you don't, you're not going to be in business very long, because you have banks and you have rating agencies and you have financial partners. And so you have to go build these arenas or find these opportunities. And yes, you have to make sure that there is an economic base and foundation that you create where they could stand on their own 2 feet, especially because we firmly believe the private sector should take the risk and the public sector should spend their money on education, safety, transportation, and the urban core. But the other side of it is, can you build a company with a moral compass? Can you build a company that ultimately has a culture in it where these things become the heart and soul of a community, that they not only become a rally cry for the community in Seattle or Austin or Savannah or Manchester or Baltimore, but you do it in a way, it's funny, we just got off a call with our Manchester team, and who else would have in their deck on a review of where we're at that we do monthly, the number of restaurants and operators and entrepreneurs that are within 3 miles of Co-op Live in Manchester, and there are vendor partners for food and beverage in the arena. And wow, that's part of the thinking of this company is, can we make a difference? Can we affect people's lives? Can we reward other fellow entrepreneurs that are just like us? Which is, my favorite saying is, don't make a decision afraid. Don't be afraid. Plow straight ahead. And we're never going to fault you if you make a decision that wasn't right. We will absolutely beat you with a 2x4 if you come along and you don't make a decision because you're afraid. Can we find other entrepreneurs that in their world, they took risk. They took moments of stress. They wake up in the middle of the night and ultimately say, oh my God, what have I done? And can we integrate them, as Francesca said, so that they're the core of these projects for service, for community, and for what we're trying to do from a commerce standpoint as well. If you could combine those two and you find the moral compass and that culture with the economic ability to make sense out of investment, it's a hell of a platform.
Yeah, it's a good segue to a question I wanted to ask right when we got started. I mean, your website says that you're disruptors in the industry. Is that kind of your method, where you're seeing that disruption in everything you just mentioned? Or is there another ethos that's referencing?
I don't think we go look at an opportunity, a project, or a business and say, will this be disruptive? It just happens that our thinking is disruptive. And so, again, I go back to that entrepreneurial spirit. I'm highly entrepreneurial. Thank goodness my daughter believes in this company and believes in this business and loves what she does. She's highly entrepreneurial. And I think the difference is, this day and age, we have a society, we have a economy, and we have a world where everybody gets polarized. And I think we're not getting enough leadership, nor do I expect this is going to change anytime in the near future from the public sector. Although I will say, my favorite person in the world from a political standpoint happens to be the governor of Maryland and the mayor of Baltimore. And so highly impressed by Governor Moore, just like, it's like, I believe you're going to see the governor of Virginia, who's also amazing, and the governor of Maryland run against each other in 4 years, mm-hmm. as they should be, because we need great new leaders. That said, I don't think people expect that we're going to solve a lot of problems when they can't even elect a Speaker of the House. So for us, I think that entrepreneurial spirit of the corporate private sector stepping in and saying, all right, let's go take risk here. Let's think outside the box. Let's dream big. Let's have a culture that thinks about private investment in urban core in markets that other people ultimately spend all of their time attacking, destroying. Let's do a positive disruption to the balance of power there. So mm-hmm. again, I don't think we get up in the morning saying our job is to disrupt. I just think that we live in a day and age where that entrepreneurial spirit, if you use it to positively disrupt, it is something that people are craving today.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I would agree with that 100%.
Speaking our language, right?
Yeah, you're speaking our language. We see it all over the place. We see it in different, we're working in different countries now, working in the Bahamas and other areas in the Caribbean, and it's the same thing. So you're spot on there. And, you know, just changing directions a little bit, though, with Francesca and talking about, you're the president of business development, you know, so this is a two-part question. I want to know a little bit about your role and what you're focused on, but also what's it like working with your dad? What is that like? Tell us.
Do you want me to leave? Wouldn't this be better if I step
She has to answer
second?
This question.
No, this is for her. We want to know what it's like.
I was telling Matt, I've worked for him for 17 years on the books. Before that, I started interning him for when I was 13, and he had a saying when I came home and started high school. He said, "Earn your keep," and that was a famous Lewicki saying. But no, I mean, I think from I'm the only child, so he doesn't have a lot of options. But I would say every day is a choice. And I think from when I was in little, I remember being enamored by his business and being enamored by this idea that you could get people together and give them a reason to cheer and be part of their memories and what that opportunity looked like. And just, I mean, it was always part of the DNA. There was never another job I wanted. And I think he, in his own way, as a parent, you know, made me earn it. It was not very glamorous when I got out of college, I can assure you. It was actually quite humbling. But I think as we've grown together and as I've, you know, seen him in action, it's just, I mean, what a better education than seeing somebody who is every day waking up with the passion and energy for our business. And also I think, you know, as he said, he started OVG, you know, 7-8 years ago, and the business at that time and what we were trying to do was so entrepreneurial that it was just, I mean, I couldn't be more excited to be part of the journey. So I think, you know, there are times he probably has fired me or has threatened to fire me, and probably times that I've never threatened to quit, but I definitely have challenged him and annoyed him. But he's incredibly respectful. And I think also, you know, it's very, very rare to see somebody in his state and his caliber of business that has prioritized not just, we have equal number of women and men on our executive team. We have, you know, female representation all the way through our board memberships and our board leadership. And so just the priority of having those voices around him, I think, is really not just for me, but for everybody. It allows a pretty open dialogue, which is great. So back to your question, business development is really a catch-all for money moving through our company. So, you know, primarily we've been focused on deploying about $5 billion of private debt and equity towards real estate arenas, primarily, and focused on that. In the last 24 months, we've really been active in the M&A world, buying service businesses. So part of, you know, our company is really simple. We have two sides of the house. We've got the development side of the house, which is our own and operated arenas. We have our seventh one opening in Manchester in April of next year in the UK, our first international property. We've got another probably, I would say, over 18 in the pipeline of projects that are international markets. So some domestically, some international. They're all at various stages. COVID definitely disrupted our development cycle. But what we really turned our gears and our attention to was acquiring additional service companies. So Chris Granger, who we were lucky to get from Elitch Entities and Teambo and a huge history in the sports entertainment space, runs OVG 360, which has grown exponentially in the last 2 years with the first acquisition of Spectra from Comcast Spectracore and during COVID. And then since then, we've acquired 4 additional food and beverage companies and a host of additional assets. So that whole side of the house has 16 service companies that ultimately any mass gathering facility should be able to tap into. So counterterrorism, food and beverage, everything from sustainability and our priority towards the environment, which is a huge critical kind of mission for our company across development and services, sponsorship, which is a huge part of it. And then obviously we just launched Crown Properties, which is one of our most recent acquisitions or sort of investments and announcements with our partnership with MSG and the Sphere and the Knicks and Rangers in the Garden. So ever growing, we are actively kind of pursuing those concurrent paths. So staying focused on a development, that's our core business. We'll always, you know, aspire to have the best arenas in the world. There's no number in mind. It's really about taking those big capital markets like in Sao Paulo where we're under construction, or Singapore or Vienna, and saying, how do you become the dominant arena in a region in multiple countries and access points? But ultimately, we obviously want to service our, you know, service is important. We're not just passive real estate money. We actually are all come from operations. And so having that partnership with Chris as we explore luxury premium and a huge priority towards taking our fan experience and taking it up, you know, I don't want to say three notches, it's like 10 notches, where you can go and have the best glass of Cabernet as well as the best food experience. We've gotten very lazy in our business on what we're willing to offer our fans from food and beverage. And so you're going to see a huge priority of our company, especially as we explore our, you know, our project in Vegas going into ultra premium, which is going to be a huge focus point for the next year.
No, that's desperately needed too. I mean, that's, and that's incredible. So the operation side of the business is all under the Oakview 360 umbrella. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
That's awesome. No, that's great. And it's great to hear from you. And I know, you know, we know that you're doing incredible things with the company and leading them in a lot of ways. And I'm sure a lot of times it's hard to get the mic, you know, when you're paired up with your dad. but we're glad to hear from you and glad to have you on as well. And I do want to switch back because our listeners need to understand the full breadth of Tim, like your experience and your career. So I just want to read a couple things about your bio and then get your thoughts on it. You know, you have over 40 years of experience in the industry. You're one of the youngest sports executives at one time in the NBA and the NHL. You went on to become the CEO of AEG. And really what I've read, and I love your trademark, is that you try and leave each stop in your career better and significantly stronger than when you found it. Words we could all live by for sure. But you've created some of the most iconic music festivals and locations, arenas, and then championship teams as well across the NBA, NHL, MLS, and other pro leagues as well. So, we talked about you starting, Oakview, you know, advancing through all those things I just mentioned. When you look back on it now, however many years in, has it gone even better than you would have expected? I mean, I know that was a tremendous leap of faith and trust in yourself and in your team, to take on this massive initiative. Has it gone as successfully or even better than you thought?
So remember, when you sit there and look at a person's bio, it's written by a person that's the vice president of public relations that works for me. So what you didn't see, and I'd like to see this someday. I'd like to see like the bio of all of the mistakes that I've made, because I've made a bunch of them. And so
no doubt.
In the 45 years I've been doing this, I always remind my daughter when she occasionally disagrees with me, trust me on this one. In 45 years, I've made more mistakes than right decisions. And that gives you a path as to experience on what you should or should not do. But it's been an interesting journey because, again, up until 7 years ago, I essentially always worked for somebody else. So I have respect that it was their money, their risk, and it was their company. And so I was a steward, but I wasn't necessarily putting my own neck on the line. OVG was a way to come along and ultimately take that risk and see, can I do it myself? And can I ultimately take the risk and put my own money to work and create a company that is born of my entrepreneurial spirit instead of doing it for somebody else? Now, had a pretty good run there with, you know, AEG's a hell of a company. I think within my career, I'm not exactly sure, but it's something like 17 or 18 championship rings. So whether it was the Lakers run where I was a board member and a partner with Dr. Buss and learning from somebody who I consider to be, he was a mentor and a good friend. The ability to have the success we had with the Galaxy and David Beckham and Robbie Keane and Landon Donovan and that, and Bruce Arena as our coach, an amazing kind of run that made Major League Soccer a different place today than it was maybe 10 or 15 years ago, going to Toronto and seeing the fan base there and being able to win a championship with the FC Toronto and then the Raptors and doing that in partnership with someone who I love and admire as much as I do, Masai Ujiri, an enormous amount of fun. But all of that ultimately doesn't mean anything if you can't come along and wake up in the morning and know it's your risk, it's your dollar, it's your failure, it's your vision. And everything mm-hmm. begins and ends with that. So I'd say I will never admit it's been as good as I thought, because I always like to tell people, I still think we have lots of chapters in our book. I don't think we've written the best chapter yet. And I believe that you got to wake up every day and not rest on your laurels. You got to wake up every day and dream about what else can I do and what else can we do? And where's the next great opportunity? The thing I love about our company is the grass does not grow under our feet. We go and we go aggressively. And I'm proud of the fact I actually think the most exciting projects we've done are not in our history. They're in our future.
Right. I love that. I love that. And you know, regarding the Beckham stuff, I watched the show the other day. It was great. And you were great in it. I mean, did you know you were making a big move, you know, for the entire industry and for the ML, you know, for Major League Soccer in the United States when you did that?
What's funny, and I give Phil Anschutz a lot of credit, we at one time, there were 10 teams in the league and we owned 7 of them, which might explain 19 championships. So it's like, well, how? You own 7 or 10 teams. You can't lose.
That's incredible.
Not many referees were going to make a bad call against us for a period of time. It was like, let's see, 7 out of 10 teams. But it was, we were stuck in mud. And I always said soccer in the United States or in North America was an interesting sport. So the best football players in the world are in the NFL. The best baseball players in the world are in Major League Baseball. The best hockey players are in the NHL. The best basketball players are in the NBA. Major League Soccer, even today, is maybe 8 or 7 in the world as to where all the great players are. And the North American fans not used to that. We're spoiled. We have an abundance of resources that we as a society could put into our athletes, our leagues, and our teams. So that's the challenge with soccer, is people would rather they'd rather watch the Premier League or Serie A or La Liga, yeah, because those are the great teams that we've all grown up with. We had to break through that. We had to figure out a way to get people's attention and prove at the end of the day that we were going to be great. And it, you know, there's a lot of attention focused on David because he's certainly one of the most famous football players ever. But I always told people the guy that we got that I think changed the league forever was Robbie Keane. Oh, yeah. Robbie Keane was one of the top 10 scorers that were an active player in the Premier League at the time, in the history of the Premier League. Mm-hmm. Think about that.
Yeah.
He was one of the top 10 scorers ever still playing at the Premier League. And Robbie was like 29. He was in the prime of his career. He happened to be sitting on the bench at Tottenham and he wasn't happy. He's a fiery, competitive Irishman. And I knew if we could go get him, he turned the league upside down, because he's what American fans want to see, a scorer. David's right. A midfielder. Robbie was a scorer. When we got Robbie Keane, we started winning championships with David, with Robbie, and with Landon. And then you suddenly saw the first creation of a super team, right? Yeah. A star-studded team that then went to every other owner. And for the clubs we own, suddenly we sold them all. For the markets we weren't in, suddenly we expanded to them all. I'll tell you one interesting story. The day we announced David Beckham at Galaxy, the Toronto expansion franchise sold more season tickets that day than at any time when they announced, and they sold out of their season tickets. It was the super team. And that super team then made everybody else understand this is what we can be. We toured Asia. We went and played games outside of our league. We suddenly were the team that other people around the world wanted to watch. And what it did is it made us understand who we could be, what we should be, and where we can go as a league. That's what David Beckham did. And it was David, and it was Robbie, and it was Bruce, and it was Landon. But it was the first time we created a team that the rest of the world gave a damn about.
Yeah, that's incredible. And, you know, I think about all the things you've innovated on, and this is changing directions a little bit and going back to Oakview. And that story kind of speaks to your vision, you know, and we have a lot in common when it comes to community and the environment. And particularly around the environment, we're spending a lot of time and energy really focusing on our sustainability initiatives at Weller and the projects we're working on from the Bahamas all the way to Napa Valley. And, you know, the Climate Pledge Arena is like nothing that's ever been done before. I mean, I you know, you could talk about it. There's hours of initiatives to talk about. Engineers worked many, 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 many years to put that together. I mean, one of my favorites is the Rain to Rink. The rainwater harvesting fills a 15,000-gallon cistern on site to resurface the ice. Things like, I mean, just things that are unheard of anywhere else. First net zero carbon certified arena. You know, the 12,500 trees that are planted, plants and trees that are planted there. It goes on and on. Tell us what it was like to, I mean, because that was a bold move. It was a big move. And you were a first mover on that. I mean, how do you, either one of you could answer that. Tell us a little bit about that and how you feel about it right now and where the world is going in that direction.
Well, I'm going to let Francesca talk a little bit about that. But what I will say is, so I was doing some media interview the other day and they said, oh, you know, you brought David Beckham over. Have you seen the Netflix series? And I said, no, I haven't, and I won't, just because I'm focused on tomorrow, not yesterday. But then I told them, but by the way, as much as you think that's important, you haven't asked me once about net zero. Yeah. And out of everything I've done in my life and everything I've done in my career, I actually think 50 years from now, I'm hoping my grandkids' kids look back at that and say, my grandfather or my great grandfather was one of the leaders on the first carbon neutral arena ever designed and ever operated anywhere in the world. I love David and I'm proud of that, but I hope our claim to fame has something to do that saves the planet Earth.
Yeah.
David's good.
Yeah.
But I'm fairly sure, by the way, he's not going to save the planet.
No, that's right. We feel just like you about these exact initiatives and towards our future and the future of our planet. So, yeah. So, Francesca, tell us more about that.
No, I think, and I'll let Tim talk about our partnership with Climate Pledge and Amazon, because I think they were a huge, they're a huge like-minded company in this. And it was an incredible partnership to find them, not just because of their location in Seattle, but just the global vision. But from when we started the process in Seattle, ironically, it was like the same month we came to Baltimore to visit you guys. So like, that's how long this process had started. I think it was like in 2017 or the end of 2016 that they had issued an RFP. But I think in the Pacific Northwest, and just given the restraints and how they were looking at it, there was no doubt that we were going to have to really tackle in a meaningful way, not just a sort of greenwashing as a lot of competitors in this space sort of like to do, but actually kind of really roll up our sleeves and think about this differently. So our first initiative before we really tackled the carbon process was renovating the roof, which actually, like, as we look back, there were so many times this project could have gone off the rails. I mean, we started construction and then COVID hit. And then we had, and as we all remember, Seattle was one of the first cities hit and frozen. And we actually had to dig out the entire arena underneath a roof that had been built for the World's Fair in 1962 and somehow keep it floating in a seismic state for the better part of almost 3 years. And man. So, and that was, yeah. That was before we even tackled the gas lines and things that were coming off of a public facility that had been around for decades. I mean, we were excavating hundreds and hundreds and thousands of square feet of cubic dirt and then mining a tunnel underneath an active street to create a loading dock. I mean, it was every single area. And I think Mortensen did a really fantastic job with Populous and helping us kind of tackle the possible under impossible circumstances. But the city of Seattle, I think, set the tempo, which is we were going to find a solution for that building. And then it became this kind of epic kind of conversation around, you know, in fact, Tim and I went to Washington because as we were in the UK dealing with our Manchester project, the Trump, I think, administration took out the historic tax credits that the project had qualified for in a Parks and Rec. And part of what we had advocated for is that by renovating an existing structure, keeping the historic roof, advocating for the history of that building, it should qualify as a national landmark. And we were successful in doing so. And then the tax reform bill came out and cut all of those tax credits out of the project. And we actually had to get into market and into DC and really advocate for this project and what it means and how you know, unaware I think a lot of our politicians are on the type of development that these projects can be for the city and what they mean economically. But Tim, do you want to talk about Amazon and just our relationship there?
Well, we were fortunate. You know, people always love to shoot at people that are highly successful and maybe have been financially highly successful. This was really Jeff Bezos. He came back to us and said, I'm not interested in putting Amazon's name on the building, but I'm really interested in putting Climate Pledge's name on the building. Can you make it carbon neutral? And I went back and I remember pulling all of our contractors and architects and project managers together saying, what do you think about carbon neutral? And they all told me it's too late. We got gas, we got this, we got that. I mean, even to the hockey trainer and the hockey equipment manager saying, no, we need gas dryers because electric dryers don't dry the equipment quick enough. And so the transformation that Jeff inspired by daring us to dream big, and then everybody rallying from M.A. Mortensen, who was our contractor, to Populous, who was our architect, to our engineering folks, to our project manager, to Steve Collins, who's our project guy, to the trainers and the Kraken. And that tank you mentioned, Mark, here's what you got to remember. That tank essentially is underground, sitting on a massive compartment of steel that then has to connect all of the water that we irrigate from the campus to then all of the water that we use in the building. And it literally, we had to go build it from scratch and then dig a giant massive hole and then set it out there on the hole below ground so that it can retain our water. And by the way, do it in a way where it doesn't evaporate. And so we had to make it, it's unique, everything that we had to do. And I think if people get a chance, they should see the building. They should see the living wall that's in the main concourse, which is in the bottom floor of a sunken building because you enter the building from the upper concourse. Mm-hmm. And then we dug a hole three times as deep as the old arena and the old hole to go build this arena. So it's a pretty spectacular accomplishment. It is a huge credit back to Jeff Bezos for inspiration and Amazon for making us dream outside the box. But what I hope, and by the way, so what came out of that is we created a company called Goal. Because what we realized is there's no way to track sustainability, right? You could talk about sustainability, like LEED certification. That's mm-hmm. not sustainability. That's how you build it or design it.
That's right.
No one tracks how we operate. So we created a new standard and a new chart that ultimately tracks month to month, quarter to quarter, year to year, every facility that's out there, starting with sports, stadium and arenas. Are we better today than we were yesterday on sustainability, on recycling, on water, on what we're serving, on elimination of single plastics, on electricity instead of gas, on metering our electricity so we know where the source of that electricity came from? And so I think Goal, which is a offspring and an inspiration of Climate Pledge Arena, Goal will be an even more impactful opportunity to save our planet and to make a difference. And over 50 different organizations, stadiums and arenas have gotten together with us, Fenway Sports, and the Atlanta Hawks, who are our partners on dreaming this up. Because by the way, the Atlanta Hawks do a better job of recycling than any team in professional sports. And Fenway did a better job of building and renovating Fenway Park than any baseball team has ever done in the history of Major League Baseball. We took the best, we took the brightest, we took people that were fellow inspirational driven fanatics towards green, and Goal may be an even bigger consequence of Climate Pledge Arena. But there is the most important thing I'll tell you. Climate Pledge Arena will not save the planet. It is a pimple on the face of the earth. We get it. Climate Pledge Arena will inspire everybody to think about how we can be more sustainable. You don't have to be carbon neutral. You just got to be better today than you were yesterday at saving the planet. And that's the goal.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. And you talk about Jeff Bezos challenging you and then you challenging the team. And it turns out you can, in fact, do it. And it was just a matter. And I've been through these own leadership challenges myself, some bigger, some smaller, depending on what the project was. But it's really about asking the question and then and really getting people to think, get outside their comfort zone and get out there and start thinking about thinking big. Yeah.
See, you'll get this. I often ask people. One of the things that was going on during COVID, and during COVID, we didn't shut down. We had seven arenas somewhere in the world under construction. Didn't lay anybody off, didn't take PPP money, didn't ask anybody to take haircuts. We plowed straight ahead because this, we believed it would eventually pass, but it would be with us forever, but we'd learn how to deal with it. But look at the amount of time and energy we as a society, the media, and the government spent on COVID. Do you know what the two most contagious diseases in the world are?
No.
Enthusiasm and inspiration.
Yeah.
I wish we'd spend as much time on that.
You are so spot on. I'm enthusiastic right now. I'm inspired.
Well,
I love it. Yeah, no, I love it. I love the whole thing, and I love the way you think, and I love that you're pushing the planet out there. Like you said, it's not that we're not gonna fix the world with this, but this is a start. It's an example, and it's the way things should be done going forward.
I love the kind of parallel to Beckham and to the MLS and raising the game of all the MLS teams, and then doing the same thing in the arena world on the environmental sustainability front. It's the same theory. You know, you did this incredible project and you're making everyone else raise their game, which is just really incredible. And congrats on that project. What I like about it, I think as much as anything else, is that you're speaking about it with every bit as much enthusiasm, but probably more than any of the other stories. And that just shows how important it is to you. So that's just amazing. So one thing I wanted, and I know I want to be respectful of your time. We got about 10 minutes left or so. So I want to just ask you a couple follow-up questions. For the arena layperson, obviously you're expert as an expert could be, where we know a little bit because we've, done some work on arenas and we've researched it, studied it, et cetera. So we're familiar a little bit, but for the average person going to an arena, you mentioned Francesca boring a hole that would become your loading dock. But talk about the design of the buildings in general and from an operations perspective and how important, certain things are, like the loading docks or, the rake, the incline of the stands, or other configuration of stages. Just talk about a couple of those things that normal people wouldn't think about that are so epically important as you're building these new arenas.
I think, I obviously, as we talked about, have been a student of Tim's in this process and I think between him and Steve Collins, who does the construction, there's no two people that have built more facilities. I think, Tim, you're on 26 or 28 or something of arenas and stadiums in your career. And I think, that experience really resonates because decisions get better. Each building gets better, I think, in our experience so far, where we try to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes twice. But I think the simple thing is, and we have a couple of sayings that have originated, in this process, which is, one, it's just math, right? Like, how do you privately finance through contractually obligated income and through your event revenue and ability to finance these projects? So kind of we root any building program in that perfect sort of balance of, like, what can the market handle? What does the market need? So that we make sure that we don't create a situation where a competitor comes in 5 or 6 years and tries to build bigger. How do we make sure that from a revenue perspective, we are, maximizing sort of our ability to debt finance these projects? And it always kind of roots itself in the program and the manifest. I think from a design perspective, Tim has two kind of famous sayings. One, we never compete with the artist. So it's really about how do we make sure that the field of play, whether it's a, concert or a comedy show or a sporting event, how do we make sure that is what's the focus point? And so we don't try to distract or do anything. The second one is no one buys a ticket to see the outside of a building. So how do we make sure that we, again, do what we need to do best, which is make sure that we look at the fan journey, make sure that we're taking that moment that the fans have given us where they're using their hard-earned money to invest in what we believe. How do we make sure that we in turn give them what they want? And one, how do we make sure that it's a seamless artist experience? So even no matter what, it's similar to sustainability. When you kind of look at our priority list on how we tackle a project, right next to sustainability is acoustics and safety, and making sure that we've got so the best musical experience, the best opportunity. And I think you'll see that in Baltimore, even with an old building, being able to prioritize where there's no echo, there's no reverb. I think, you know, people used to say you could hear the concert twice with the same ticket. That's not something we aspire to do. So we want to make sure that that's a huge priority. Having a great relationship with Live Nation and obviously Irving Azoff always makes us think about the artist experience, the back of house. They're doing, you know, 40, 50 shows. How do we make sure that that dressing room makes a difference? How do they make sure that their staff feels good? And then the other one is just the fan, making sure that each seat, each configuration really maximizes that experience from them. So I think it sort of sits hand in hand. We always kind of root, we're entrepreneurs, we're a privately held company. We've got to stick with the numbers. But from there, we really make sure that we prioritize that bowl experience.
So thinking about the numbers a little bit, not necessarily always financial, but just how these things work, arenas better off with an anchor tenant or not? Like, what's the sweet spot of how many anchor tenants and so on? You hear different points of view on this, and I learned a lot from working with you all and being near you all. But what are your thoughts on that?
So look, anchor tenants. So I won't tell you which bank and which banker, but when we were just getting going our first 2 or 3 years, a banker that I had known for a very long time said to me, yeah, you know, I don't get your Austin project. I don't understand how you can make sense out of spending almost $400 million on an arena that doesn't have an anchor tenant. Today, one of the five most successful arenas in the world is Moody Center. It is a classic example of a perfect partnership between the private sector and the public sector. Ourselves, Live Nation, and Matthew McConaughey built it for $375 million. We then donated it back to the University of Texas, one of the largest single gifts in the history. We operate it, we run it, but it's now home to University of Texas for their men's and women's basketball team. But it's the music that drives it. So without having the anchor tenant, it's one of our most economically most profitable investments we've ever made, because we don't have, one, the conflict of dates, and two, we don't have to give half the money away to the anchor tenant, who sometimes they could be like heroin addicts because they need the cash to go pay the players.
Yeah.
So it doesn't always work in Seattle. Probably you can't go spend $1 billion and not have an anchor tenant, because then someone's going to go get either an NHL team or an NBA team and build another arena and compete with you. So you got to, every market is different. In Baltimore, we don't need an anchor tenant. We can live off of college tournaments. We can live off of AEW, WWE, and UFC, as I like to call them, alphabet soup. We can live off of music. We can live off of family shows. We can live off of culture and entertainment. And that's how that building works. Every market's different, and every project is a little bit of a out-of-the-box thinking about what will work in Manchester, England, where we don't have any anchor tenant. And that, I think, is going to be our second most profitable building. And again, everyone laughs about Manchester, and I'm like, you don't understand. For 20 years, when I was on the other side of competing, the Manchester Arena was the second busiest arena in the world for music. It's a massive marketplace. We figured out a way to build the most expensive and the biggest arena ever built outside of North America, period. So Co-op Live will be the most expensive arena ever built outside of the NHL or the NBA. But what you're going to see is it'll probably be the most successful, because we just did 7 nights of Take That. We did, 5 nights of Liam Gallagher. Liam Gallagher. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a place people are going to want to go to listen to music, because it'll be acoustically And from a design standpoint, an experience standpoint, a food and beverage standpoint, it'll be the best experience for music anywhere in the world outside of North America.
Yeah, you know, and one thing this crosses over to also is all the mixed use development we've done and all the hospitality development we're doing, the rising construction costs, high interest rates, cost of capital, and so on. How, especially the construction costs, they're really putting a crimp in these deals on paper.
And these deals are massive to begin with.
These are massive. How are you working through that? What are you doing to get through that? Or are you just, is it deal by deal right now? Because there's been an escalation of probably 35, 40% since 2019 in many of these markets.
We charge for podcasts now.
you're gonna charge Travis and
Francesca said you all were paying to be on this. Is that
it? Yeah, so it's a good question. So what we've done is we've acknowledged the obvious. It costs more to build these things. And so we're being a bit more conservative. We're building fewer. And the ones we are building, we're taking a lot more time to build. So patience. Vegas is a good example. We have a vision there to build a brand new arena that if the NBA makes a decision to expand, and that's their decision, and if they come to Vegas, that we're building it specifically to be one of the best new NBA arenas ever built, similar to what you see with what the Warriors did in San Francisco, and how amazing that particular building is, or what Steve Ballmer's doing with Intuit Dome in Los Angeles. We wanted to be one of those arenas, next generation thinking. But we've taken our time, and now instead of thinking we're gonna push dirt first, second, or third quarter of next year, it may be fourth quarter of next year or 2025. One, we think interest rates will come down by then. Two, we have seen costs of goods go down now, finally, but it just requires some patience. And we have right now two buildings under construction in the world, too, because we did slow down and we did push things out and we did grow a little bit more patient. Now, the other side of the business is, as Francesca said, we're finding dozens of new business opportunities to go acquire, some in the food and beverage business, some in the hospitality business. We bought maybe the best hospitality catering company in all of the UK in Rhubarb a couple of months ago. And now we're doubling down and we're about to buy a couple of other companies in that particular space. We're aggressively pursuing NCAA food and beverage contracts. We're spending a lot of time in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, and we're going to be the project manager and the operator of the brand new arena that they're building in Diriyah, which is going to be one of the world's great arenas. So we have preoccupied ourselves with other opportunities, other businesses, and other ways to grow our company. We've gone from 4 employees to 40,000 employees. Our EBITDA has doubled year after year. So what we've figured out is take advantage of the economics and the stress that creates by finding businesses that ultimately are out there and probably in a position where they might be a good acquisition for us to lend to our core, and then take the bricks and mortar and wait for things to calm down.
Wow, that is just amazing.
That spun from value engineering into that pretty quick.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah. It's just, there's a lot that goes into it. And I mean, we could talk to you for 2 weeks, never mind 2 hours, but we do have to bring it to a close. And want to thank you so much for your time. This was really just unbelievable.
Yeah, we're always so inspired. We just love watching all the stuff you all are doing. And we love using your venues. We love everything about what you're doing. And especially, like I said, the give back to the community and the give back to the environmental side of things is really remarkable and unique. And I think it sets you apart from everybody else.
And also just the vision of all these different things, having the vision and pushing forward to the future and kind of setting the standard on a lot of different fronts is really just incredible to hear about. So thank you.
Well, I always love spending time with people I admire, fellow entrepreneurs and fellow dreamers. And maybe all of us together, the four of us today, inspired other people listening to this. Think outside the box. Don't make decisions afraid. And understand, inspiration and entrepreneurial spirit Those are really good contagious diseases. Spread them.
You just gave me my title for the podcast. That's amazing. So thank you so much. Thank you, Francesca. Great to talk to you both. A huge thank you to Tim Leiwicki and Francesca Bodie of Oakview Group for joining us today. If you have a suggestion for a guest or topic, hit us up at Weller Development on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Thank you for listening. I'm Matt Rienzo. He's Mark Weller. Keep building, people.